And at a time when podcasting is booming, CBC has this, I think, unexpected huge hit. And then they did not commission a third season from you.
Yeah.
Why?
Before we even finished Finding Cleo, actually, I was told that, like, there wasn't going to be another podcast in my future. Like, that was it. That it was, like, it took too long and it's too expensive. And their focus was on television at the time. And so, you know, I thought once it was a big success that, you know, it had this big impact and was kind of beyond being, like, I think, a really important story about not just Canadian history, but, like, the 60s scoop and what was happening today, that it was also, like, you know, digital and reaching new audiences and hitting all these marks. I thought that would be revisited, but it wasn't. So eventually, when I realized I wasn't going to be able to focus on podcasting at CBC, I started looking outside of CBC.
Well, let's actually back up and rewind and talk about your time with CBC. Mm-hmm. And I think for the rest of this interview, I'm just going to ask you questions about Street Sense. I actually could. I love Street Sense.
Street Sense was amazing. That was such a good show. It was so good.
I wish they still had that. I want
they
my
They do
kid.
Have, apparently it's digital now. It's only on TikTok.
Okay.
But yeah.
Street Sense
they did bring it back.
But you've talked about your experiences at CBC as an Indigenous journalist and, like, coming really, like, face-to-face with systemic racism at the broadcaster. Can we start with, like, your time as an intern in Halifax?
Sure. That was my first job. I was an intern on the East Coast in Halifax for CBC Morning. And honestly, like, I was a terrible intern. I really had no idea what I was doing. I was really not a great intern. But I was part of the Donaldson Scholarship, so I was there chase producing for the morning show and so booking guests to come on to talk about whatever was happening in the news. And that summer was a really big news story on the East Coast, was the conflict between the Indigenous and non-Indigenous fishermen in Burnt Church. And I had booked a chief to come on the morning show. It was a Friday, and I booked him on the Monday. And I remember my producer at the time, because probably I was such a terrible intern, like, grilling me about the details. Like, he knows what time and where to go. It was a wall box, like 6 a.m. or something, mm-hmm. like 7 a.m. And I said, yes, yes, he knows. And she said, because you know those Indians, they'll go out drinking all weekend and they won't show up on a Monday morning. And I remember just, like, looking around immediately to be like, did anybody else hear that? Like, is anybody else paying attention? And that was the first, yeah, that was, like, that moment's kind of seared in my...
That was said about a chief who you'd booked.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm not the only Indigenous person who's worked in newsrooms who has a story like that, or multiple stories like that.
Then you find yourself booking a morning show in Toronto.
No, I became host of Street Sense. I did that for 4 years. I moved to Toronto. And then after Street Sense was over, I was working in current affairs at CBC Toronto for a CBC News Sunday for many years.
Okay. And that's where you had another incident.
Yeah, when I was working on CBC News Sunday, I got an email one day, and this was before social media, back when people used to send emails and say, please forward to their entire address book. And I got an email that a girl I knew from back home had gone missing. And her name was Amber Redman, and I knew Amber because she was the same age as my sister. And we actually, my cousin and I coached her in volleyball at the Saskatchewan Indian Winter Games one year.
Uh-huh.
And her family had, like, forwarded a picture of her and said that she was missing and asked people to share it as widely as they could. And I remember just thinking, like, this should be on the news. Like, people should be paying attention to this, you know? And that summer, Alicia Ross went missing from Toronto. And that was front page news. That was on the front page of the Globe and the National Post. And
she was Caucasian.
She was white and she was blonde. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, these are so similar. Like, they're both these, like, young, beautiful women who have, like, these families who are just desperate for information and help. And they had this, like, bright futures, and they've just vanished. And Amber's case barely got any local coverage, even in Saskatchewan. And so I, at that time, the show I worked on, part of our mandate was to cover media. So I went to pitch a story to my boss about these two cases and like, the disparity between the coverage of these two young women who had so many things in common. And she put up her hand and stopped me, like, before I could really get into my pitch and said, this isn't another poor Indian story, is it? And that was it. That was kind of, that was the end of it. And I guess those are just really, like, very specific, clear examples of the kind of systemic racism that just permeated newsrooms mm-hmm. and media for so long. Like, I think, obviously, that's changed, is changing. But I think that doesn't mean that something is happening to another Indigenous journalist somewhere right now
yeah.
that we should be paying attention to.
I mean, this is why I think scrutinizing the media is worthwhile beyond just, like, specifically criticizing, you know, this news outlet or that one, is that it really is a window into, like, what we care about, what we give attention to is always a reflection of what we think people are going to care about.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that a missing white girl is, like, our perception is, like, that's huge. That's good for clicks. And then there's this other perception of, like, ugh, roll eyes, another missing mm-hmm. Indigenous girl. We're this filter through which larger systemic problems kind of get crystallized and visible.
Yeah, absolutely. Because look around. Who's with you in a newsroom?
That's the other thing, is that it really matters who's making the call. And so I want to ask you about your role in creating what was then called CBC Aboriginal, now known as CBC Indigenous. Can you talk about that?
Well, I had worked on Eighth Fire right before that. And that was, like, the first time in my career, at least, where there was, like, significant attention and resources put to, like, an Indigenous or Aboriginal project. And that was a documentary series, a four-part documentary series. We were initially supposed to have 5 episodes, I think, and it was on primetime television, and it was hosted by Wab Kanu when he was still at CBC. And it was meant to be, like, the Indigenous side of this 500-year-old history of Canada that was inclusive of, like, Indigenous people from coast to coast to coast and in English and in French. Like, it was a very ambitious project.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult, but also, like, so meaningful and important. Like, I remember, like, I can still remember how incredible it was the first night that the first episode aired. And, like, you know, I was sitting on my couch and I had my BlackBerry and my laptop and I was, like, one of my first times live tweeting and being on Facebook, but also just seeing Native people with accents on primetime television sharing our stories. Like, I remember just feeling like, I wish my grandma was here to see this. Mm-hmm. I wish other people were here to see this. And it was the first time also that, like, my family really cared about a story that I did. Like, you know,
right.
I've been working in journalism for a long time, and I'd been working on Eighth Fire for months. And then after it aired, I remember people being like, oh, my God, Eighth Fire, is this what you've been working on? Because people were talking about it. Like, we Indigenous people were finally feeling like we were being represented. Because even though, obviously, there's so much diversity, there are so many shared experiences. And it was the first time we kind of had that. And then so I pitched that we should create, like, a permanent space online, like CBC Aboriginal, that was kind of like a place for all of the content that existed at CBC on radio, on TV, and on
digital. From the regions, across different media, and putting the lie to the conception, like, oh, there's a limit to how much people want to hear about this stuff, in a really interesting way, because not only are you discovering that there is a huge audience, but if the journalism is Indigenous-led, if it's by Indigenous people, there's a huge Indigenous audience for it. And, like, what a realization of what the CBC could be.
But at the beginning, it was kind of like, okay, yes, we can do that. And I think at the time, I was the only full-time reporter, and I had a senior producer in Winnipeg. And we had a day each month of Duncan McHugh and Gillian Taylor and Marelda Fidler and Angela Sterrett. Like, we could get, like, one day of their month so that they could file something
right.
for CBC Aboriginal.
And you were a founder of this.
Yeah. But initially, like, there were times when we were beating whole regions in terms of our page hits, like, you know, like small regions like PEI and New Brunswick, but still, like, for CBC Aboriginal, like, now that doesn't maybe seem that surprising. But at the time it was like, okay, this is our initiative. And then it was like, oh, this is actually getting traction and you guys are finding an audience. And it led to everything else.
Okay. So we have, like, some sort of, like, accomplishment to accomplishment.
We didn't talk about any of the failures yet.
Well, I certainly was paying close attention to this because this was such a booming moment for podcasts, and I was looking enviously at CBC's success with your second series and this incredible proof of concept that not only could you tell a story in such depth, not only could you tell an Indigenous story, but people around the world would listen to it. And then everyone's waiting for the third season, and you're told that there won't be one. And the next thing I heard was they put you on the Fifth Estate.
Who did you hear that from?
I have people. What's the story there?
They asked if I would be part of the Fifth Estate.
Such a weird statement about CBC values that, like, if you've got a podcast series that millions of people are listening to, oh, put her on television, because I think there's still this idea like TV is the pinnacle.
You know, I think CBC has incredible opportunities, but they also have incredible challenges in terms of, like, you know, the funding they need and they get and how reliant they still are on television and mm-hmm. the advertising from TV. So, I mean, I think that was just the reality. But that absolutely was the idea that, like, oh, this is a successful podcast. Let's bring that to the Fifth Estate, or let's bring that more to the National. Or
that's like graduating, like that's a step up or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw you on the Fifth Estate.
So. No, I never did that.
So what happened?
I mean, it's like a big, long story. You probably don't want to hear it.
What show are you on? This is Canada Land.
Yeah, well, what happened was, like, I had been asked to join the Fifth Estate. And, you know, it was obviously a change in my job. And so they offered me a new contract. And I remember that it was actually less money than I had made the previous year because I had worked so much overtime on the podcast. And I was like, is this right? Like, how is this possible? And I said, is this comparable to other hosts on the network? And it wasn't. I learned and discovered. And then so I asked for them to change that. And they said they couldn't. And then I said, I can't be like the only Indigenous reporter who's not making, you know, the same amount as other hosts of like flagship investigative shows. And so then I said that I wouldn't do it. And so then I didn't do it.
And that was it for how long had you been at the CBC?
At that point, I had been at the CBC for about probably like 18 or 19 years. And then that's when I really more seriously started looking outside the CBC for opportunities.
I mean, that is an incredible story to an institution that has these stated goals. Somebody who should be celebrating you, you know, they put you on the air, you know, interned there. They should be claiming you as like...
CBC is like a huge part of who I am as a journalist. Like there's so many... Like, there's so many problems everywhere. I don't think they're unique to having problems. But also, there are so many incredible people who work there and so many people who, like, were incredibly generous and who gave me opportunities and who supported my career.
Like, I have a much shorter history than yours there, but I know that conflict of, like, I owe so much to this institution that taught me so much and that, you know, gave me these opportunities and put me on the air. And yet, I'm almost because you know what it could be or what it is at certain moments. The fact that you told the story of surviving St. Mikes, a Canadian story, putting on the record the most comprehensive journalistic document of a residential school to millions of listeners, earning you a Peabody and Pulitzer Prize, and not for the CBC, where you worked for almost two decades, where you were a founder of their Indigenous news unit, is a huge statement about the CBC.
Yeah, I mean, I felt really sad about leaving the CBC, honestly. Like, I was really sad to leave when I did, in a lot of ways.
There was a lot of cheering, I think, about the fact that, you know, in the old days, it's like, if you don't like it here, tough shit, there's nowhere else to go. And it was amazing to see when podcasting boomed that there are all these other places where talented audio people could go and tell stories. And this thing that maybe was undervalued by CBC, Gimlet saw value in. Mm-hmm. Somebody, you know... Tell me that you get 17 million downloads. That's worth something. Aside from the journalistic value and everything else that this has to contribute, just from a purely business point, like that, like, are you kidding me? You let that go. So Gimlet hires you and you go on to do this incredible work there. That was exciting to see.
Yeah, it was all of the things. It was exciting and terrifying and it was all of the things for sure.
And then in the cycles that we always witness in this industry, Gimlet is...
No longer, yeah.
Yeah, it's absorbed into Spotify. Spotify basically gets rid of it. Can I ask, how's it going? Is the next one underway?
Yeah, we're working on season 3 of Stolen right now, launching early next year. It's not just Gimlet and Spotify, like, you know.
The industry.
The industry mm-hmm. is really going through a lot of challenges right now. And I think, you know, especially for shows like ours, which are limited series and investigative, it's difficult. But I feel like, you know, still committed to wanting to do this work and to like getting to I'm feeling so grateful that I'm still being supported to do this work in spite of all of the challenges that are going on in the industry right now.
You talked about how one of your editors at the CBC once asked you, like, oh, like, how many more of these stories can you really do of tracking down, whether it's one of the thousands missing and murdered and putting, like...
It was like, MMIW specific that time.
Yeah.
And it was not, like, I mean, yeah, it was, I think, came from a place of ignorance. Like just not understanding, like, not maliciously, mm-hmm. but a feeling like... oh, these stories are all the same, and not understanding or realizing like the potential and the how like each of these stories is actually it's just an entry point. It's like a way to get into a bigger story. And I have always like when we started doing the podcast and we did the first season, and it was really like heavily focused initially on the mystery, on like, you know, we went out there to look into Alberta Williams' unsolved murder, and it was like Marnie Luke, my producer at the time, she and I just like really just pulling the yarn and all these twists and turns and coming back and like pitching this podcast that was so focused on like these plot points. And when we were writing, I was writing episode 4, and that was the year that Colton Bushy was killed in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And some of my colleagues in Saskatchewan organized this conference because there was so much problematic coverage, so much terrible coverage following Colton's death. And they wanted to like help journalists do a better job. So I went out for this one day. It was called Reconciliation in the Media. And the keynote speaker in the middle of the day was Marie Wilson, who was one of the commissioners of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but also a former journalist at CBC for decades. And she, like, she was speaking directly to me, but she was, I felt like, giving us all shit for not doing a good enough job as journalists and talking about how it's our job to connect the dots. And if we can't explain the context, like, it's the most important thing we need to explain, especially when it comes to Indigenous people and communities. If we can't explain the context in this story, explain it in the next story. Like, and she said, think about it. When did this story actually begin? And I thought about Alberta's story. And I was like, where does Alberta's story begin? Because I'd been talking to her family for months at that point. And I realized, like, this family had been through so much that this, like, losing Alberta was a part of their bigger family story that was much bigger than this unsolved murder. And I thought about how her story, in a lot of ways, didn't even begin with her birth, that she was part of this bigger story, that her family was connected to this bigger story. And so we ended up including, like, some of the context of residential schools and how it had impacted her family in season one. But I feel like that was like this pivotal moment for me where I was like, this can be something bigger than a single thing. This can be like, each season can be like a different facet of life for Indigenous people.
And I think starting from the personal and then broadening out. And then we you know, in finding Cleo, it's like, what, 20,000 kids were in the 60s scoop. But like, it's this like, we're going to look at one. We're going to find one, and we're going to tell the story of this one, what happened to her.
And it can be anyone. And that's what that one producer didn't understand, is that, like, each story is like an entry point into a world, a different facet of life and understanding that, you know, he didn't have in that moment.
So many thoughts. So, yes, the more you narrow in and focus in on one tells you the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just sort of like this feat of journalism that you actually did find the answer to what happened to Cleo, and you found the grave.
That was Marnie Luke.
The whole thing is engrossing and involving, and it takes it from a statistic, 20,000, to the one, but the one makes you care about the 20,000. So on the one hand, we can say, well, how many more can you – well, each one could tell you about the whole. But then there's another ethic at work here as well, which is that each one is a universe unto itself. And, you know, I don't know. I follow this Twitter account where every day they just post another photo of a child who was murdered at Auschwitz. And, like, it's chilling. But each one is this reminder of a universe that was snuffed out. Each one is a reminder. And each one is – it is worthy of taking the time to remember all these many years later. And I feel that. And I don't even mind that, like – there's an honesty to the ignorance of that question. Well, how many more can you really do? Because it allows us to actually think about and talk about why it is so worthy to tell each of these stories. I think that you opened up such a rich vein of journalism and found a purpose of, like, this is what journalism can do. And it's so humanizing to focus on each one of these people and take them from a statistic and dedicate you know, sometimes a year or two of your life to telling their story. And then talking to you right now, I understand, A, the kind of journalistic passion that, like, you found such a wonderful format for doing such important work, and you're racing against the clock because the records disappear every year. And there's so few people doing the work that you're doing, and you have such a rare opportunity that you have funding to do it. And yet, I feel like, and I worry about, I know the toll it takes from having some incredibly limited experience of doing the kind of work that you're doing, and that I needed a break after involving myself in long-form investigation and some very tragic coverage of Indigenous issues. And I have this privilege to say, that really got to me. Let me do some dumb shit for a while. Like, let me do a story. Let's do a story about a cocaine smuggling ring advice magazine with my colleagues here. Or let's, like, I can go and leave this issue and shield myself and protect myself. And I have the privilege of, like, having fun. I don't feel that it's all on my shoulders at all. I can kind of, I try to walk into it respectfully, but I have the ability to kind of just self-care, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Or, do you ever need that break? Do you feel like you can take that break?
I mean, yeah, I think I could probably go and do a different job somewhere else or do different kinds of stories probably at this point if I wanted to. But I don't want to. Like, I feel like because probably so much of my life and my career has been people ignoring these stories, that now it feels like I have opportunity. I'm having impact. I'm like, I need to, like, harness this momentum and keep going. Like, I definitely don't feel like I want to step away. And I think, like, the premise of that question is, like, that it's, like, a part of my life or something like that, but it encompasses my whole life, you know? Like, this is not just my job. What I'm trying to do is, like, is embedded in every part of my life, you know? It's about, like, being a Cree girl growing up on a reserve in Saskatchewan. And, you know, in the community that I have, that, like, this is bigger than a job for me. This is kind of part of what it means to be an Indigenous woman. And also that, like, I have a lot of privilege, like, in that. That I have so much privilege in terms of, like, the circumstances I'm in now, in terms of the opportunities I have now. And with that is a responsibility, I feel. And that's something that, you know, is very personal and something that I think was ingrained in me because of where I grew up and because of my family and my mother and my grandmother, all my aunties, like, everybody has gone through stuff and they keep going and they prioritize family and community. And, you know, you're trying to do better and make it better for your kids and your nieces and nephews. And that's what this is to me.
There's a lot of conversation lately about trauma-informed journalism, and your colleague Duncan McHugh has written a book about kind of best practices for covering these issues. Mm-hmm. You're working with people who are dealing with some of the worst things that have happened to them in their lives. You're asking them to get very deeply involved in things that are very difficult for them. How do you do that in a way that is respectful of the trauma that you are triggering, the trauma that you are asking them to face?
Yeah, I mean, that honestly, like, that's something I feel like I'm really still learning about, or I have been learning about. And I think that, like, at the beginning, especially when I started reporting on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, like, I remember, you know, feeling so guilty about having to ask people about the worst moment in their lives, or, like, and realizing that, like with my family, like, every family I was talking to, like, this was not the only difficult or traumatizing thing that they had been through. And feeling like I could also see the harm in that. Like, I could see how it deeply affected people. And I always wanted to, like, you know, check in with people and make sure that they felt like, you know, it's about being there in the moment with them and trying to, like, ensure that they're okay in the moment and that you're leaving them in a good place and you're checking in with them. And after we did Finding Cleo, I remember, or, like, while we were doing Finding Cleo, I remember one of the ideas around promoting it on social media was the creation of this Facebook group where, you know, it's like a group where people get together and talk about the latest developments in podcasts and like what happened this week and the search for Cleo. And I was like horrified and I was like, no, absolutely not. Like, this is their real life. This is not like only entertainment or like, you know, and Johnny and Christine or Crystal now, she reclaimed her biological name or like. They're here. Like, they're real people. They're going to be paying attention to this. Like, how are they going to feel if people, you know, and I remember feeling, like, so protective of them. And then when the podcast came out, like, they, I think, still engaged with every single tweet that has ever been tweeted about finding Cleo. I could see that this was an empowering thing. You know, at a certain point in the podcast, I feel like part of it was, like, my search for Cleo. And then we realized, wait a minute, this is not my family. Like, this is Crystal's family, Christine's family, and we should hand the microphone to her and document her quest because this is her search for her sister. And the fact that, like, the family felt like they had the agency and were empowered to tell their own story in the way that they wanted to tell it and that they were leading the investigation, it seemed like it was actually this really positive thing for them that they then, you know, could see their story being shared and that it was having impact and that people were appreciating it and that it was this, you know, and I was like, that was an enlightening moment for me. And then I started actually learning about trauma and learning about PTSD. And I did a fellowship at Dart at Columbia University. And I learned about, like, how people heal from post-traumatic stress. And one of the ways is by telling your story, like literally the act of telling your story in an environment where you feel safe, in an environment where you have agency, in an environment where you have some control. And I realized that that actually can be a healing experience. It doesn't have to be only harmful. There can be harm that comes from it. There can be pain that comes from it. But it is there, but it can also be healing. And I feel like that was honestly, like, crucial work for me before taking on Surviving St. Michael's, because I feel like that's part of what that podcast was for me. It was obviously our investigation, our journalism, but it was part of my story and reclaiming my own experiences.
Connie, thank you.
Thank you, Jesse.
That's your Canada Land episode. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Editor-in-chief around here is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Cold. Our syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Thank you. high. It's a really different experience than VOCs and petrochemicals. And I'd like to think that it lasts longer. Everybody could get it if they got their hands dirty.